Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. Why, you might ask, are we playing Deep Purple? Well, more about that later. On this evening's The Space Show, we have the fourth and final in our series of Ray Bradbury stories. We follow that with a largely musical commemoration of three tragedies that, by a strange twist of fate, struck the United States manned space program within a week of each other by calendar date. We'll explain the significance of that music later in the show. This is the Space Show with Andrew Rennie. Now consider these dates: January 27, January 28, and February the 1st, all within the span of a week. But the significance of these dates is separated by 36 years. They lie 49, 30, and 13 years in the past. To be clear, think 1967, 1986 and 2003 respectively. It is on those dates the American space program suffered its greatest tragedies. On 1967, January the 27th, 49 years ago today, three astronauts were 2 weeks away from launch in what was planned to be the first manned flight of the new Apollo spacecraft. As the three astronauts and the ground support team neared the end of a long day of tests, fire erupted in the capsule. Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, unable to escape, died. On 1986, January the 28th, 30 years ago tomorrow, the 25th Space Shuttle flight was launched from an icebound launch pad. Aboard the Challenger were seven astronauts, including the first teacher aboard a shuttle. Some 73 seconds after liftoff, STS-51L exploded at an altitude of 14.6 kilometres and a speed of 3,100 kilometres per hour. The crew compartment rose to 22 kilometres, then fell to the ocean, impacting at 300 kilometres per hour, 27 kilometres northeast of the Kennedy Space Center, and sank in 26 metres of water. On 2003, February the 1st, 13 years ago next Monday, Space Shuttle Columbia broke apart at an altitude of 60 kilometres above Texas during re-entry. STS-107 had been launched on 2003, January the 16th, on a 15-day scientific mission. Hit by foam insulation from the external tank, Columbia's wing leading edge had been damaged during launch. The seven astronauts included an Israeli national and an Indian-born naturalized U.S. citizen. Also aboard was a whole lot of Australians. Yes, not humans, but Australian spiders. Well, on this evening's The Space Show, we commemorate these three tragedies in song, and in the case of Apollo 1, the reflections of Ed Buckby, who spent a career with NASA's public affairs. We begin with public service broadcasting with a song, well, a musical item called Fire in the Cockpit. Fire in the Cockpit by Public Service Broadcasting, about the Apollo 1 fire. Ed Buckby had a long career in public affairs at NASA, mostly at the Marshall Space Flight Center. A few weeks ago, he spoke to a meeting organized by the Space Association of Australia at the Mail Exchange Hotel in Melbourne. And he had this to say about the Apollo 1 accident and reactions to it.
Here we are. We've flown 16 times. Not a scratch on an astronaut. Apollo 1. Running a ground test. We have a short develop. We have a fire and we kill three astronauts. Ladies and gentlemen, it brought NASA to its knees. Many of us thought the program was over. We would never make it to the moon. We would go on and do something else. That was a wake-up call. But men like Von Braun and others in the NASA family, Divas from the Cape, came together and said, we can fix this. And they did. 18 months later, we flew Wally and his crew on Apollo 7. And Wally was the first guy, and he never let us forget it, by the way, to fly Apollo successful. Now, Wally is the only astronaut to fly Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. And it was a very successful mission. It gave everybody confidence in the spacecraft. And, of course, the Saturn worked well. We were so naive in those days, we didn't think that ever happened. And that was a wake-up call, man, big-time shock. The crew, you got to understand, the astronauts really didn't have that much of a problem with it because they had test pilot buddies that died in the cockpit, you know, and that happened to them. So they were comfortable, you might say, with a fatality. The problem was the families. The families really took it hard because they had no idea that their guy, their dad, their husband was going into a dangerous type situation. They thought flying on rockets was, you know, big deal, safe. So it was a shock to the astronaut families more so than it was to Shepard and, you know, and Wally, because it was like, well, that's just part of the deal, you know, we're going to lose some. But to us, as I said, it brought NASA to its knees. You know, NASA had been declared perfect. No problems, no mistakes. 16 astronauts had flown, not a scratch. And all of a sudden, you kill three people on the pad. You haven't even flown. It was a shocker. And I thought it was over. Many of my buddies thought the program was going to be shut down. And we were preparing, looking for other jobs. But I tell you, guys like Von Braun realized that this could be fixed. And they went in and found the problems with the spacecraft. It was just poorly designed from day one. So fixed that, and Apollo 7 proved that baby was ready to go. And really, that was all we needed, was that one test flight. But it was a shocking experience. And of course, NASA was not prepared for the press invasion. They closed the gates. They did everything wrong. And here we are, the press guys, you know, trying to communicate with the press. NASA shut us down, wouldn't let us talk to anybody. So for about 3 months, it was NASA, the press just hammered NASA, just hammered them. And they got terrible press because if they had opened the... See, we had done everything openly. We had never had a gate closed for a launch. Everything was open. All of a sudden, they closed the gate. Don't show anything, no pictures. And it was a bad time for us in the press room, because we had to go back and tell our press friends, you know, we can't talk to you. That was just not acceptable to the press. So they sent the ambulance chasers out, and these guys didn't know anything about the space program, and all they talked about was, we killed three people. So it was an interesting experience for us in the press corps, because it was exactly the wrong thing for NASA to do. We wrote a whole new deal, and guess what? And it was, you know, here's how you handle it in the future. You know what they did? They threw that away, and as soon as Challenger went down, they went through the same damn thing. Locked the gate, stopped talking to the press. They never learned, you know. So when you have an open program like NASA is, a civilian agency, no classified information, you've got to understand the public expects to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we learned our lesson, particularly with Apollo 1.
Give us something to that. As a PR person, prior to the Apollo 1 launch pad disaster, did you ever hear anything from the other astronauts saying that mistakes are going to happen, or we don't like where this is going, someone's going to get killed? I think Chirac called it go fever. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you know, that generation of astronauts accepted failure and accidents much more so than the later ones came along. The Gemini, Mercury, well, I'd say the 34 astronauts that I mentioned on those flights, those guys were fighter pilots, test pilots. They had lost buddies, you know, and they knew what that was like. They were better prepared for it. I think the families were the ones that were shocked, because they thought the guys were moving into a safer business.
Yeah. You know? I was just wondering if anyone had told you prior to that, like Chirac apparently didn't like the pilot command.
Yeah, well,
hung a limit on it.
That was Grissom. That was not Wally, yeah. But, yeah, there was some talk about that. Yeah, there was some talk about... But, you know, North American Aviation designed the X-15. They should have known how to design the Apollo. So that's why the astronauts were pretty comfortable with North American Aviation, because they had X-15 was some kind of a rocket plane. So I think they were not really prepared for all the flaws and things that showed up afterwards. But, yeah, Grissom was very outspoken. We would not take him in front of the press at times, because he was too... He cussed a lot, used bad words, and that always drove us crazy, you know. But, you know, he was true. He was very accurate. He's very true. You know, he'd tell you the real deal. And so he knew probably knew more about what was going on there than many of the others did.
Apparently, according to John Young, in an interview years later, he said that Grissom was actually a bit too afraid to mention all his misgivings about the command module. And he apparently told John Young, he said, in the conversation, that why don't you voice up to NASA management? He said, if I do, they'll fire me. Does that sound right?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that that was a closed-type environment, because guys like Deke Slate, he would listen, I guarantee, and so would Shepard. See, Shepard and Slayton were grounded at that time, and they were really running the astronaut office. We had to go through them for get anything done, and they were knowledgeable. They knew what was coming along. I think they thought that they needed to do that those testing procedures to really identify the problems. And see, we weren't about to launch. We were still going to ground testing, but that plugs in, plugs out test was everything was buttoned up, you know, and you had 100% oxygen, and we had never had a problem with 100% oxygen. And boy, when we had a spark in that thing, it just like an explosion. And of course, the hatch was terribly designed. No. So, you know, it was a learning experience. But Shepard said this to me. He said, you know, I look at that as a failure, and I lost some friends. But he said, you know what? That probably prevented us from having a failure out there 5 years from now. And I think he's probably right. We got to go.
Wrap it up.
Yeah.
And that was Ed Buckby talking about the Apollo 1 accident, which happened a long time ago, 49 years ago this week. Well, Julia Eklar has written a song about Apollo. It's called Memorial. Here it is.
When you sing of Columbia or the Eagle and reach for the stars as your ultimate goal, recall who fell along the way, for the star road takes a fearful toll, the star road takes a fearful toll. And it might have been Armstrong, and Shepherd, Carpenter, Cooper, or Glenn. They all knew well the quester's fee and the star roads paved with the lives of men. The star roads paved with the lives of men. For the price was paid on a winter evening when fire in the spacecraft, somebody said, in smoke and flame the shadow passed.
That was Julia Eklar with her tribute to the crew of Apollo 1, who died, of course, on the launch pad. And she says that, whilst we rightly remember Apollo 11 as the first lunar landing, we should also commemorate the crew of Apollo 1. And to make sense of those lyrics, Columbia was the Apollo 11 command module, Eagle was the Apollo 11 lunar module, and Capsule 12, that you heard a reference to there, was the manufacturing number of the Apollo 1 command module. We have more on this sad theme coming up after these messages.
Hey, we're Haskell!
Woo! And you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
We move forward now to 30 years ago, and here is a song by Michael Longcore. It's called Pillar of Hell, and it's a remembrance of the STS-51L accident, which many people just simply call Challenger. Okay, we will have more about that in a moment, but first let's just hear a little bit more of our theme music here.
Thank you.
Now, Michael is ready now, like Michael Longcore, with his song Pillar of Hell. Do listen closely to the lyrics.
I remember the day that the Challenger died. I remember the shock, I remember I cried. I remember the blast when their proud ship fell, and the seven who rode on that pillar of hell. We grieved for the loss of their spirit and skill. But the high frontier is a frontier still, and they died for a cause, in our memory they dwell. The seven who rode on that pillar of hell. And then came the whispers, the laying of blame, pointing of fingers, the naming of names, of the ones who abandoned the truth now to tell. The seven who rode on that pillar of hell. The starched little men with their mean little minds, with their schedules and costs and their bloody bottom lines, who contract and kick back, who buy and who sell, and who never will ride on that pillar of hell. And now there's no moon base, we don't fly to Mars. But you can't kill my dream, you can't deny me the stars. What gold cannot buy, what I'll never sell, the chance that I'll fly on that pillar of hell. I remember the day that the Challenger died. I remember the shock, I remember I cried. I remember the blast when that proud ship fell, and the seven who rode on that pillar of hell. Seven who rode on that pillar of hell. And before you kill my dream, I will see you in hell.
Michael Longcore there, Pillar of Hell. We now move forward to the year 2003. And February the 1st of that year, well, that was February the 2nd here in Australia, we had an space shuttle in orbit. It had been up there for a bit over about 2 weeks, and it was making a re-entry when the wing was burned through and the vehicle broke up high over Texas during re-entry. It was only a quarter of an hour away from landing at the Kennedy Space Center. Well, Columbia was the first space shuttle, and its lifetime was celebrated in song by a group called Echo's Children, which is the playing name for Cat Faber and Kelly Hills. And in 2003, Catherine Faber wrote this celebration of the first space shuttle to orbit the Earth and as a memorial to the STS-107 tragedy.
She was first among our shuttles, and we watched her from afar. Lift off soaring angel plume, re-entry's falling star. She 16 minutes out from home, she faltered in her flight. Lost communication and broke up in beads of light. And my heart is soaked in sorrow as it slowly understands. Columbia Sky Strider is falling. Shaken now to know what our founders could have told us 200 years ago. Pictures start before us, spelled out the flyer's fates. 100 miles of wreckage lay strewn across 2 states. Scraps of twisted metal, across the fields of memory, a black and smoking scar. As a people and a nation, we have paid a price to learn that in any exploration, there are some who don't return. We are neither fools nor cowards to be shaken now to know founders could have told us 200 years ago. Across a waking nation, the shock and sorrow ran from sunny Amarillo to the forests of Spokane. From India to Israel, the mourners claim their own. Heroes, but we do not grieve alone. As a people and a nation, we have paid a price to learn that in any exploration, there are some who don't return. We are neither fools nor cowards to be shaken now to know what our founders could have told us 200 years ago. Columbia is falling, yet her journey isn't done. The secrets of the universe are dear and dearly won. In every generation we find some dreamers rise, set their lives at hazard to give us all the skies. As a people and a nation, we have paid a price to learn that in any exploration, there are some who don't return. We are neither fools nor cowards to be shaken now to know what our founders could have told us 200 years ago. As a people and a nation, we have paid a price to learn that in any exploration, there are some who don't return. We are neither fools nor cowards to be shaken now to know what our founders could have told us 200 years ago.
Hey, why not check out the Southern FM website, www.southernfm.com.au. There are presenter profiles, latest news, station information, and podcasts so you can listen to shows you might have missed. Southern FM, your voice in the community.
And I'll explain why we were playing that song after. Well, now let's do it now. This song, it's not actually a song, it's an instrumental piece, but it's a tribute to the STS-107 Columbia crew, which died in 2003, just, I think it was about 13 years ago or so. And this was written by guitarist Steve Morse. And the Columbia broke up over Texas on 2003, February the 1st, during reentry. Now, one of the STS-107 crew members was Indian-born Kalpana Chawla. In India, Deep Purple is a popular and much-loved band. Well, she traded emails with the band members for several days while in space. She had taken three compact discs with her on Columbia. These were Deep Purple's 1972 album Machine Head, Deep Purple's 1996 album Perpendicular, Rainbow's 1978 album Down to Earth. Now, Deep Purple band members Roger Clover and Don Airey were also members of Rainbow. The band members were horrified by Columbia's fate, and guitarist Steve Morse channeled his emotions into composing Contact Lost within an hour of the accident. The three CDs were found among the Columbia debris, and NASA used them as part of special commemorative plaques honoring the seven astronauts. Chawla's widower, Jean Pierre Harrison, presented the three plaques to the band at a ceremony on 2003, September the 23rd, in Mexico City. The Machine Head and Down to Earth plaques were donated to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The Perpendicular plaque has been kept privately. The track Contact Lost was the final one on the Bananas album, which was released in 2003, October the 7th. Contact Lost by Deep Purple in honour of the STS-107 crew.